Hello, and welcome to the 19th episode, the 19th of the Functional Nerds. We're the guys who like to sit around and talk about computers and technology, science fiction and fantasy stuff, and music in all its forms. Then we record that talk and share it with you, our faithful listeners, every Friday. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author and blogger, and I publish my stuff over at atfmb.com. I'm a podcast dude and an all-around functional nerd, no matter what Ottinger says. My partner in this is John Anelio, who could not be here tonight because he got the call to be on the Wired.com Geek Dad podcast. And when you get that call, you answer. But through the magic of the internet, John is still here to say hello tonight. So say hello, John.
Hey, I'm John. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy and other nerdy kinds of things, and I post most of my stuff up at scifisongs.blogspot.com. Every week we do have a nice guest, and we've been very fortunate in the quality of guests that we've been able to get. I've been quite surprised and delighted.
True enough, John. This week, our very special guest is best-selling tour author L.E. Modisette Jr. I had the privilege to have a conversation with Mr. Modisette and recorded it for posterity. So let's jump right into that conversation with, again, best-selling tour author L.E. Modisette Jr. So our guest this week is L.E. Modisette Jr. He is a best-selling author published under Tor. And I don't know, have you published under other publishers besides Tor?
Not in recent history. Okay. My first book was published by Simon & Schuster, and my second by Avon. And since roughly 1985, I've been with Tor, and I got the first two books back, and Tor republished them. So,
nice. Very cool. And like I said, you are a best-selling author. I think you've... I tried to count at one point, and I think you were up to close to 40. It might be more than that now, because I know you've done several in the Imager series.
Actually, Imager's Intrigue, which came out today, interestingly enough, is, if I recall correctly, my 56th book.
Wow. Wow. 56? And that's just that's just in the the last 25 years.
Well, not really. I did about 7 or 8 books in from roughly 1980 to 1990. The bulk's been since then, but when I was working full time, I was writing about a book a year.
Wow! And you know what? Let's actually talk about that for a second. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be such a prolific writer.
Well, I certainly didn't start out to be a prolific writer. As a matter of fact, I started out to be a poet.
Oh, wow.
And a poet. And wrote poetry in high school, did a senior project in college as a book of poetry, and wrote poetry that got published in small magazines, but not anywhere else during the time after college and while I was a Navy pilot. I didn't write a science fiction story until I was, I think, 29 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I only wrote it because somebody suggested that I'd always read science fiction, and I wasn't having the greatest luck in becoming a big-time poet. So why didn't I try a science fiction story?
Are there any big-time poets?
Probably in the United States, probably not since Robert Frost.
Right.
If we're going to be honest about it.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. So
but what does reality have to do with dreams?
Not a lot. So someone encouraged you to write a science fiction story.
And I wrote The Great American Economy and sent it off to Ben Bova, who had just taken over as editor of Analog. And he sent it back to me with a note that said something to the effect of, "You really screwed up page 13. If you can fix it so that it makes sense, I'd like to see the story again."
Hmm.
And I did. And he bought it. And then I wrote something like 25 to 26 stories before I sold the second one.
And you said you were a Navy pilot? I wasn't aware of that.
Yes. Well, actually, I started out after college as an officer in the Gator Navy, the amphibs. And I decided I really didn't like small boats. As a matter of fact, I didn't like them so much that I volunteered for flight training at the height of the Vietnam War, which is probably did not go down as one of the smartest moves ever in personal history. And I may have been one of the worst pilots to ever get through flight training.
Really?
I basically got through flight training on the strength of ground school and intellectual ability, not piloting ability. And my first tour after getting my wings, they sent me to the Pacific Missile Range facility out in Hawaii. And they sent me there because they knew that I would be under the tutelage of a very experienced senior Navy pilot. And he really taught me how to fly.
That experience, is that where you draw on so much of your military stories from?
Well, certainly from the experience. I mean, my second tour was with HC-1, which was a helicopter support squadron based out of the old Imperial Beach Naval Station. And that was search and rescue off of carriers. So between being an amphib and two tours and various aspects of helicopters, that's the experience, yeah.
Gotcha. My uncle actually served in Vietnam, and his dad said, you know, it's really bad over there. Do what you can just to keep your head down. And he ended up becoming a cook to try to kind of stay out of combat. That was, you know, what's interesting to me is we talked to Andrew Liptek a little while ago, and he's written a lot of things about military science fiction. And part of the conversation kind of went down the road of a lot of the authors who write military science fiction have served in the military, and they do draw on those experiences. And I was kind of saying, you know, we haven't really had a major, major offensive other than Iraq and Afghanistan for new young authors to kind of draw on.
Well, I think that that's true. And the other thing about that is you have to look at the numbers involved. If you look at, say, World War II, there are a fair number of science fiction authors who came out of World War II with that sort of experience, but there were close to 10 million men who served. If I remember the numbers correctly, there are over 5 million who served in Vietnam. I'd be very surprised if that number is more than a couple million, despite the fact that the Afghan War is the longest conflict we've ever been involved in. Because what they're doing, we don't have a draft.
Right.
And what they're doing is they're basically rotating people back and back and back. I mean, a former student of my wife's was in the National Guard, and when he finally got out, over the space of something like 8 years, he'd had 5 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Wow.
And that's not atypical.
That's crazy.
Well, that's an all-volunteer military force. I also think it has an impact, and it doesn't have much to do with writing, but I think it also has an impact on the political side of it. When you had people being drafted, and you were getting an armed forces from a broader spectrum of society, when the war in Vietnam did not go well, you had a tremendous amount of broad-based political opposition to the war. Because there was a feeling of, one, minorities were being picked on, people who didn't want to be there were being picked on, great upswelling of anti-war sentiment across the country.
Mm-hmm.
We have some of that today, but I think it's muted a great deal because the impact is distributed among the population on across a much narrower segment of the population.
Gotcha. Yeah. Now, I don't want to give people the impression that you
write military science fiction, because I don't feel that you do. I feel that you write science fiction and fantasy, and there are military elements within that.
For the most part, although I'd have to say that there are a couple of books which really are military science fiction. The Parafaith War is definitely military science fiction.
Right. Okay.
And there are others that have sections that are certain military science fiction. But no, primarily I do not write exclusively or even predominantly military science fiction.
So let's talk about your books for a second, because as I've said, and pretty much everybody who knows me is aware, I am a huge Modisette fanboy, and I have a shelf dedicated to your books. You have the Imgur portfolio, which is a newer series. The Korean Chronicles, which is also a Korean or Korean with a C.
I call it Korean.
Korean. There you go. Which is also a newer series. Then you have the... Oh, I'm going to screw up all these names.
There's the Spell Song Cycle.
Right.
Which is a five-book series, really a trilogy and duology, all with all female protagonists.
Yes, and I want to talk about that in a minute.
And then there's the Recluse Saga.
Yes, and that is obviously the largest of the groupings here. How many books are in Recluse so far?
16.
And Arms Commander, I think, is the latest one.
That's right. That came out in hardcover in January. It's not out in paperback yet.
Yep, I have the hardcover sitting over in my to-do pile to read, along with the first in the Imgur, which I haven't read that one yet either. So sometimes you get ahead of me in your writing, you write faster than I can read.
That's what my wife says too.
So, I did want to ask you a little bit about the Spell Song Cycle, because, and I wish that John could be here, because John is a musician and he writes music based on science fiction and fantasy. He's written things like, George R.R. Martin Is Not Your Bitch. Which was in response to a question that I think Neil Gaiman received, where someone said, you know, aren't authors supposed to meet expectations of the fans, you know, and the fans are expecting things. And he, you know, Neil Gaiman basically said, George R.R. Martin's not your bitch. And John ended up writing a song, became kind of a big hit. The Spell Song Cycle is, at least when I read it, to me it was very unique. You have a lady who's...
It's very unique from a lot of perspectives. First of which is the protagonist.
Right.
Especially in the first three books.
Anna
is a middle-aged divorcee with an ex-husband who's not exactly wonderful, who worries about her weight, who's just lost a daughter in a tragic accident, and is so frustrated with life that she wishes she were anyplace else. She is also a very junior university professor of voice, a technically trained classical musician. And she gets her wish through a series of circumstances we won't go into, and finds herself in a world where the technical application of music does constitute sorcery. And it's also possibly one of the most chauvinistic places that one could imagine.
Yes.
And the question, the situation that she's in is, technically, she's probably better than any sorcerer on the planet. But she knows absolutely nothing about sorcery, only about the music that will control it.
Right.
And the question is, can she learn enough to survive before everybody figures out how much of a danger she is?
And we won't spoil it for you. You should go read the books. How did you decide how that whole music and magic structure was going to work for that universe? You know, it was like songs. First you had the voice, then you had instruments. You had, if you put them together, that made them stronger. If you could do harmony, it sounded like harmony was the most powerful of all, and therefore very few people even tried it.
That's pretty much correct. How I got there, it's actually pretty simple in a convoluted sort of way. I'm married to an operatic soprano who is a professor of voice. And
So a little bit of inspiration there.
And like Anna, she actually taught for a while at Iowa State. That was before we were married, but nonetheless, that was when she was married to her first husband. Nonetheless, said about that, the better. But the question actually came up in my mind, what would happen if you had a universe where this sort of magic existed? And based on her experiences as a teacher, and mine as well, because I did teach college literature and actually science fiction and composition for about 4 years when I was making the transition to being a full-time writer,
mm-hmm.
I realized that there would not be very many sorcerers, because first, the ground rules I set up meant that you really had to be able to sing technically and on key. Secondly, the words had to make sense for what you were trying to do. Third, if you wanted to have any power behind it, you had to either have an extraordinarily powerful voice or a lot of accompaniment, and for the most powerful stuff, harmony. Now, all of that means that not very many people are going to have that kind of ability, particularly in a world that doesn't have technology, a high level of technology. Because without a high level of technology, you can't build a broad-based, should we say, artisan class that really goes into sophisticated music.
Sure, they were basically horse and cart.
Right, but if you look at music through any culture, the most complex music has always come from the most complex and advanced societies. To be able to really harness that kind of ability requires that kind of society, and these societies weren't there. So you have somebody who has got the equivalent of a jet engine among carts and buggies.
Because she has the knowledge.
She has the knowledge. But the problem that you have, even for the sorcerers that do exist, is even more fundamental than that. One of the things that I've noticed over the years is that most voice students are both egotistical and self-centered. They have to be to survive in that kind of a profession. However, if you happen to be a sorcerer and music can do this sort of damage, exactly how many of them are you going to trust?
Right.
And under what circumstances? Because you're going to be very careful about who you give that ability to. And the problem from a vocal point of view is if you don't train a voice somewhere between puberty and probably about 30, it'll never reach its full potential. So voice training is required at a time when people are the most self-centered and egotistical. This is going to have a great limitation on the number of sorcerers one way or the other.
Right.
Because if the sorcerer isn't careful, he or she's going to end up dead. If they are careful, there aren't going to be very many pupils. Either way, there won't be many.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember there was a lot of that distrust between the people who had the power and the people who didn't. And there was also jealousy from, and I'm thinking of one particular musician in the books, who kind of, you know, wanted to be better and wanted to have more power than he actually had.
Oh, yeah. But that's pretty much the basis or the ground rules under which I was operating.
So your wife inspired some of this, obviously. Did you have any particular musical background yourself when you were putting that together?
I was possibly the worst clarinetist who ever picked up the instrument. And I mean that very seriously. My parents wanted me to have musical training, and so I got it. But I am sort of, let's put it this way. I've got a pretty good ear when somebody else is playing or singing.
Mm-hmm.
I have no ear at all when I'm doing it.
Gotcha.
Second, my wife has discovered that I am one of those few people who has absolutely no sense of rhythm whatsoever. So consequently, an awful lot of the knowledge in that book is either frustrated musicianship or secondhand knowledge gotten from observing my wife in action.
So the actual songs that people are singing...
Well, no. No, the songs in that sense are fairly real, because, as I mentioned earlier, I was a poet.
And that's what I was going to mention. Yeah, I was thinking if it was just poetry or actual lyrics with tunes.
Well, no, a lot of them are lyrics with tunes, but that's not a problem. Because if you're a poet, you can match cadences, even if you can't hear the melody.
Gotcha. Well, for me, it was a great series. I always like the strong female characters, and you see more of it now than you used to.
That's partly because there are frankly more women writing today than when I started.
Well, and even the male writers are writing strong female characters now.
Well, that's because there are an awful lot more women reading now. I mean, you also have to look at the change in the field. When I started, fantasy had barely started to take off. The bulk of the field was science fiction, and the bulk of that was hard science fiction. Today, I would doubt if hard science fiction constitutes more than 5 to 10% of the fantasy and science fiction being published. Hmm. Most of it's fantasy. Women tend to read much more fantasy than hard science fiction. I won't say there are women who don't read hard. I won't say that there aren't women who read hard science fiction, because there certainly are. But the majority of readers don't read hard science fiction anymore.
Hmm. Well, I threw it out there on Twitter that I was going to be talking to you, and did anybody have any questions? And one person did leave a comment that they wanted you to know. She said that she was struck in the Spellsong books by your ability to capture aspects of being a middle-aged woman that many authors might have ignored. I see that as a compliment. I mean, you know, there's, you know, someone basically saying, as a guy, you captured a middle-aged woman very, very well.
Well, I've lived through a lot. I mean, it's no secret. I've been married 3 times, although, thank goodness, I've been married to my present wife almost 20 years.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
But I also have 6 daughters.
Oh, wow.
And they are all of the women in my life, including my mother and my grandmothers, were extraordinarily strong women. And you are influenced by what's around you.
Yes. I agree with that wholeheartedly. I have a strong mother and a strong grandmother who raised us, and that comes through in the stuff that I write myself. So, no, I totally get that. And one of the themes that's in the Spellsong cycle, but also translates into other things like Recluse, is the concept of a balance. Your magical systems always have a balance. You know, Anna was able to do great things, but it also took a toll on her body.
Well, that's true of everything in the universe. And it's one of the things that got me into fantasy, writing fantasy to begin with. Because we as a species are a tool-making species. And if magic did exist, we'd use it as a tool, because that's just the way we are. But making and using tools exacts certain prices. And in essence, the more complex the tool, the higher the cost on something, whether it's the user, the environment, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just simply a law of nature. Call it an offshoot of the law of conservation of energy and matter. But it is nonetheless the way any real universe works. And I've always embodied that concept in what I've written.
And you've done it really well. I mean, it's always stood out to me, at least. It's similar in the Recluse books, as these wizards, for want of a better word, run around and you know, do these great and terrible things. They're also constantly eating and drinking and falling asleep and losing their eyesight and all kinds of stuff happening.
Yep. Because I believe that any talent exacts a toll on the user, whether it's a magical talent or it's a very mundane talent. Artists are prone to carpal tunnel syndrome, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And more than a few artists have suffered from eye strain and problems with their eyes.
I saw something, and I can't remember if I actually saw it on your website or somewhere else. And by the way, I really like your website, which is elliemodisettejr.com. And I like it because, like you said, you've been around. You're an older gentleman, and some of the older authors, when I go to look for their websites, they are terrible websites. And I think that's just sometimes it's a disconnect in technology. Your website is fantastic, and I love it.
Well, I have to admit, somebody else designed it.
Of course. I figured.
We went over it, and it's put together in such a way that I can handle all of the content, some of the simpler technical things.
Mm-hmm.
But if it gets really complex, I have to call on somebody who really knows what they're doing.
Sure.
But I'm at least smart enough to know, for the most part, what I can do and what I can't do. But it also struck me that given what I observe on the web, my site's really a compromise between who I am and what people want. I can't do the total interactive thing, but I try and make it as open as possible, allow people to make comments, etc. I don't know what else to say than that.
Well, you know, I like I said earlier, I'm a nerd, and you know, I do this stuff on the internet, and I've built websites, and I like it. I think it's clean. And really, the point was that a lot of authors don't necessarily do a huge amount of stuff on the web, and therefore their websites reflect that. So I really like that it's there. I like that you have a blog. It's easy to find information on there. You know, you answer questions for people, which I think is really cool. So, you know, I just wanted to say that. But I can't remember if I found this on your blog or somewhere else. And I want to say it was a quote attributed to you where you basically said, fans of your fantasy novels probably won't like your hard science fiction novels.
I don't know if I said probably. I said they may not, if I recall correctly. And
may
it
not.
Is on
okay.
The website.
Okay.
And basically, I have three classes of fans. Those who only like the fantasy, those who only like the science fiction, and those who like both. I have no idea exactly what the distribution among those fans is, but I do know that all three classes exist.
And why?
Because enough people have... Pardon?
I was just going to say, why do you think it's split that way?
I think part of it is that people have their own preconceptions about what they want to read. And some people really only want to read what they consider hard science fiction. And other people have a preconception that they're put off by anything that's that scientific. And I don't think it's so much a reflection of what I write or how I write it as a reflection of what people want. And they will pick and choose, as all readers do, that which appeals to them.
Sure. I just find it, you know, interesting that a lot of times you find an author and you like what that author puts out there. But what you're describing isn't alien to me because, and I have to admit this, you know, I love your fantasy books and I struggle with the science fiction books.
Well, the science fiction books are frankly a little bit more complex. In more than a few facets.
Gotcha.
Because in many of them, I won't say all of them, but in many of them, both the economics and the science is a bit more complex. It's not necessarily obvious because I don't think either the magic and fantasy or the technology and economics and hard science fiction should be at the forefront. they're part of the supporting structure.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, they do influence the story.
And now, I mean, you do have sci-fi elements within your fantasy books, though. You know, people essentially, or at least appearing to cross over from one universe to another. People flying around in spaceships, crashing to the planet and taking up residence. And
only in a few cases do I go that far. As a matter of fact, there's only one book where one fantasy novel out of all of them where a spaceship actually appears.
Is that The Fall of Angels?
That's Fall of Angels.
Yeah.
However, there is low technology, shall we say, or maybe even, I wouldn't say low technology, call it 19th century technology, throughout the first three books of the Imager portfolio.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
You might call it an analog to early French steampunk.
Okay. Yeah, and like I said, I've got Imager sitting here. I haven't. And in fact, I think it's a signed copy, but I haven't actually gotten to read it yet. Now that brings me to another thought. If someone has never read anything by you, what would be your recommendation for the first thing that they should pick up and read that's going to, you know, help them get into the worlds of Elie Modisette?
When somebody asks me that question, my first question, I actually ask a question in return, which
okay.
is, what else do you like to read?
Gotcha.
Because my stuff, it covers a fairly wide spectrum. I mean, if you take, for example, the Ghost Books, that's an alternate world murder mystery thriller series in a world in which ghosts are real, but the technology is literally 1990s. With a few twists.
Mm-hmm.
So people who like mysteries, frankly, tend to like that particular series. Fantasy readers.
And the dog is not a fan, apparently, of the Ghost series.
Well, actually, there are four of them.
Oh.
Dogs, I mean.
Gotcha.
Fantasy series... The most popular is Recluse. I think the way things are going, Imager will probably be the second most popular. The least popular, frankly, is the Spellsong Cycle.
I mean, really?
It's popular, but it's not as popular.
That's a tragedy, because that's a fantastic series.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed is that books that I have written that people become extremely enamored of, almost fanatical about particular books, are often not the most popular books overall. If you take the Recluse series, for example, one of the books that's not terribly popular is the second book, The Towers of the Sunset. I mean, it does okay. I mean, it's even better than okay, but more than a few people have said they've really struggled with it. But the people who like it really like it. And they say that, oh, it's the best book.
I'm trying to remember, is that the Creslin book?
Yes.
Okay.
And, of course, part of the reason is, for those who have not read any of my books, I do not use the same styles, even in the same series.
Sometimes you won't even use the same character twice.
Well, as a matter of fact, there are no more than two books about any one set of characters in the Recluse series.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of books where there's only one book about those set of characters. But what I was talking more about is style. Some of the books are written in the third-person past tense. Some are written in the first-person past tense. Towers of the Sunset is written in the third-person present tense.
And people struggle with that.
People do indeed struggle with that. Some people do.
Hmm. Well, I just remember, since we're talking about Recluse, you know, I got back into fantasy in the, 2000, 2001, and I went down to a Barnes & Noble. I was living in Knoxville, and I was looking for something to read, and I am definitely a fan of a series, so I like it when something goes on for more than one book. And so I looked at the shelf, and here were all of your books, and here was The Magic of Recluse. And there were, you know, multiple other books that were all, at least on the surface, it looked like they were all in the same series. And so I picked up The Magic of Recluse, and I took it home, and I read it, and I was very angry with you. I think his name was Lyris. Was the main character? Yeah, right. And I was just so angry at that guy because he was talking about how bored he was, and he wasn't particularly your typical fantasy character. You know, there's if you read certain fantasy books, there's like a journey that the character goes through, and you take him on a completely different journey. And you know, I don't want to spoil it for people, but he didn't get the girl I thought he was going to get. You know, he didn't. It was this kind of a frustrating book. And when I was done with it, I went back down to Barnes & Noble and I bought the second book, which was The Towers of Sunset, I believe. And I thought, I'm going to see where this guy goes now.
And it's a totally separate set of characters.
It is. It's completely different. You know, it's set in a different time. I think the whole series spans like 2,000 years or something on this little world full of island nations. So the second book didn't have anything, at least in my head at first, didn't have anything to do with the first book. And I read that one, and I actually liked it. I don't know why people would have a problem with it. And then I went and got the next one, the next one, the next one. And, you know, it wasn't until
it's the fifth book that Lyris comes back in.
Right. And you kind of see, as you read that, you see what you did and what you've continued to do, which is kind of give us little glimpses of this place or that place or how things work here or how things work over there on all these little islands. And then when you put everything together, you've got this very rich and full story. And I don't think anybody else has ever done that before.
I'm not aware of anybody else who's done it. I mean, there are so many books published that you can't say,
sure,
I'm the only one who's done it. But the way I've structured that, I don't know of anybody. The closest to it that I know of, and it's not as far-reaching, is Marion Zimmer Bradley's Darkover books. And they're much more... They have what I might call fantasy elements, but they're basically hard science fiction. And I think she wrote 19 of them. But they're more loosely woven, at the same time about a more restricted set of circumstances. It's probably the best way I could describe them.
Well, I want to say that you kind of turn things on its head for me, because you did things like, you know, you kind of made it that the Recluse was the good guys and Fairhaven was the bad guys, and the good guys wear black and the bad guys wear white. So yeah, that was kind of just a little subtle switch, you know, and it just kind of went on from there. You set up in that first book that really the people from Recluse are kind of the good guys, and they're trying to be orderly. But really, my favorites of the series are the ones about Sayador.
Mm-hmm.
The Magi, the Scion, the White Order, and the Colors of Chaos. These are some of my favorite books in that series. And really, the Colors of Chaos and I think the White Order...
Mm-hmm.
Tell the same story that we've already seen in The Magic Engineer, but from a different point of view.
That's something I've also never seen done before.
That was cool, because you know, it didn't really dawn on me until I think I was like halfway through, when I realized that I was seeing a scene that I had already read just from a different point of view, and I'm going, wait a minute, I remember this.
Mm-hmm. And if you compared them side by side, you would find that I changed absolutely nothing in terms of the factual happenings.
That's amazing.
Or even the conversations.
and see, that's another thing that
I see. go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say that's another thing that I don't think I've seen other people do before.
Well, yeah, you've basically got heroes on both sides fighting the same war. They're both sets of protagonists are, in fact, heroes,
mm-hmm.
at least in terms of their own cultures. They're both pretty likable, and yet they're opponents.
In the first book,
Magic Engineer.
You find yourself rooting for them, for the two brothers. And then when you flip it and you're in the White Order and the Colors of Chaos, you're kind of rooting for.
You're rooting for Cyril.
Cyril, yeah. So I mean, it's extremely clever, extremely intelligent. Like I said, I've never seen anybody do anything like that before. Some of the stuff that you do, when you kind of give us these little glimpses of that world, it reminds me of like Dennis L. McKiernan and Terry Brooks, because you also show us that this world changes over time. Things change, people change, names change.
Well, yeah, and you often see in the earlier books, which were written later, you see images, you see people as real people who are referred to as great legends, and you see the difference between the legend and the real person.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and like I said, you know, I think it's particularly similar to McKiernan because he'll run things 10,000 years across when he's writing his books. You know, you'll see here's this elf who was here, and then now here he is, you know, 30,000 years later. And you see the changing.
I think Dennis stretches out a little far, but.
But, I mean, it's the point is that, you know, nothing stays the same. Things change.
No.
People change. Stories change. And that's that, again, that's really intelligent. I think a lot of the reason that. People follow your books the way they do is because of how intelligently they're written.
Well, I certainly hope so.
So you said that as far as the website's concerned, that's set up to be as easy as possible for you to use. You don't do anything else web-wise. You're not into all this social media, are you?
Like no, Twitter? I don't do Twitter, don't do Facebook. I do have a forum on the internet database. There's an L.E. Modisett forum, and I will answer questions there as well.
Gotcha.
A link. There's also a link on my website to that forum.
Okay, very cool. So right now, what do you have out on the bookshelves? You know, what are your current projects that people should go and check out?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, literally today, the third book of the Imgur portfolio, Imgur's Intrigue, went on sale.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about Imgur? Like I said, I haven't actually read the first book yet, but I do have it here.
Well, basically, in the Imgur portfolio, it's a world which has a form of magic called imaging. And certain individuals, fairly genetically rare, numbers about 1 in 400,000, if I recall correctly, have the ability to visualize things into being. Now, it's not a free gift, because none of mine are. And if you attempt to visualize the wrong thing in the wrong place, you can literally kill yourself. And about a third of all imagers die before they reach 21 because they literally overextend themselves. Consequently, on one nation, Zaladar, there is a collegium of imagers, and they basically have evolved a relationship with the society and the government, which on one hand protects them, but demands services of them in return for that protection. And the first three books deal with Renthal, who is starting out as a journeyman artist. Well, actually, he starts as an apprentice, but he becomes a journeyman. And he's a portraiturist, because they have different schools of art. Only portraiturists do portraits, and landscape artists do things without people in them. And it's a guild system, and the technology is roughly 1850s. They have steam engines, ironclad warships, and what have you, but they're not to the point of electrical energy or telegraphs. And Renthal discovers just about a year or two before he's due to become a master of portraiture that he's an imager. And in a series of tragic events, he discovers he has to be an imager.
Hmm.
It's not a question. I mean, literally join the collegium. And the first three books deal with his progress from discovering this comparatively late in life, because most imagers are discovered earlier, through various adventurous political situations. It's a different kind of story in the sense that it's what I would call a capital city story. And by that I mean many, as you mentioned earlier, many fantasies deal with a journey, and that journey is physical. You go here, you go there, you do your quest or what have you. In Renthal's case, for the most part, in the entire three books, I doubt if he's, except for one instance on one trip in the third book, he's never more than 30 miles from the center of the capital.
Hmm.
But it deals much more with politics and intrigue, although there's certainly a fair amount of adventure, violence, and considerable threat to life and limb, Renthal's life and limb, in the first three books.
Well, you've definitely convinced me that I need to move it up in the list of things that I have sitting here to be read.
And other things that are on the burner, so to speak, is in October, I'll have out a standalone hard science fiction novel, and that's despite the title, which is Empress of Eternia, but it's hard science fiction.
I'm sorry, could you give me that title again? You kind of cut out.
Empress of Eternity.
And that's a hard science fiction novel?
Yeah.
Is that...
standalone.
Okay.
It's standalone. Starts several hundred thousand years in the future on Earth. And it's actually three intertwined stories, each about a team of scientists, each team is several hundred thousand years different in time from the other teams. And they're all trying to probe the mystery of a canal that stretches across the mid-continent of Earth, which is impervious to any form of energy and is largely, except for one set of chambers, sealed.
Hmm.
And if one of those civilizations does not succeed in stopping its opponent, literally, the entire universe will cease to exist. And the question is whether they can figure out the mysteries of this ancient canal in time to do that.
That sounds very interesting.
Then next March, I have the eighth book in the Corian Chronicles. And it's the second book about Michaela, who you may have seen or read about. She was the main character of the Lord Protector's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Lord Protector's daughter was, shall we say, a fantasy version of the classic princess fairy tale. My own fantasy version of it. The sequel, Lady Protector, is what I've loosely entitled, And What Happens After the Fairy Tale. when the bill, so to speak, comes due.
And something tells me you're going to turn that on its head as well.
Well, you'll just have to see.
I did want to ask you, you blog quite a bit, and I follow your blog, and you always have very different, very intelligent points of view on different things. What are you thinking about the ebook industry that's kind of soaring a little bit right now? All these little ebook readers, people publishing electronically versus traditional press. You know, where do you see the publishing industry today? Where do you see it in 10 years? How do you think this is all going to affect it?
That's really, I mean, you can make a lot of predictions about it. Obviously, the ebook industry has taken off at least to some degree, especially in the last 3 or 4 months. It's taken off in ways that I'm not sure a lot of people totally appreciate, and I'll give you one example of that. My mother, who is just a totally voracious reader, and who is 90 years old, bought a Kindle.
Very cool.
She never thought she would. But she's had problems with her eyes. And the Kindle allows her to increase the text. And a number of her contemporaries have also bought them. And that's something that I don't think anybody predicted. And I only mention that because I'm not sure that people fully recognize the ramifications of this in many ways. The second problem with this situation is that when you're transferring an electronic file, you've got accounting problems, or you could have accounting problems. If a publisher does a paperback or a hardcover book, you have a physical object that has to be transferred. People can keep track of it, mostly. I mean, there are always some losses, but the transfer of money goes with the transfer of the object. That doesn't follow on electronic books, and there have already been some talk about, should we say, cooking the books in terms of electronic downloads and what have you.
No, boy.
And this, I think, is going to be a problem because you're relying to a certain degree on straight honesty. And while most people are honest, publishing is a field that's very low margin, no matter what anybody thinks. And if there's significant loss in terms of the revenue in terms of ebooks, this could be a real problem and could lead to some form of encryption or what have you, which I don't think is a good idea. But you can't publish and lose money. You're not going to keep doing it. So that's a problem that I don't think has been totally sorted out in that sense.
Did you happen to hear about the press that was putting out books that they didn't actually have the rights to? And
oh, yes.
The authors were kind of flipping out over that?
Oh, yeah. I know about that press. And actually, as a matter of fact, that also happened with a couple of Kindle titles on Amazon. It wasn't large scale, but there was a little kickback on that because Amazon realized they didn't have the rights, and they literally erased those books from everybody's Kindles, and that caused a furor.
Yes.
And that's one of the problems that I see with the whole electronic thing. The other thing is that paperback sales have taken a real nosedive over the last 8 or 9 years, to the point that on the average, paperback sales are 30 to 50% lower than they were for equivalent titles, so far as the publishers can determine, as opposed to a decade ago. I'm not sure that ebooks are going to make up that difference entirely. And Macmillan announced 3 or 4 months ago that they had determined that every single title they'd ever published in the last 2 decades had been pirated. Well, this is going to have an impact. And the impact is going to be, and I've written about this before, but the impact's going to be largely on what I would call the mid-list authors. Yes, if you're Nora Roberts, J.D. Robb, Patterson, even Brandon Sanderson, you're still going to be out there. Your sales may go down, but your sales are large enough that you're still going to be publishing. But if you're a mid-list author who sells 5,000-6,000 hardcovers and 30,000 paperbacks, if you drop much below that, you're not going to be profitable. And so if you see a 10 or 15% drop in sales, all of a sudden you may not have a publisher.
Now, one thing, Mike Resnick last week was telling us about how the Kindle for him has kind of been a blessing, because what he's been able to do is take the books that are out of print and publish them to the Kindle, where, you know, before they were just out of print, no one could get them. Now they're on the Kindle. He's making more money because he's not going through a publisher. He's putting them out there on the Kindle, and he's making 70% on an ebook and on a book that was out of print and no one could find before.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's certainly a possibility. And again, it depends on who you are. I mean, Mike's been around for a long time, and he's got a backlist, and he's got a following. But you have to have a following who knows who you are, and that your name means something.
Sure.
And if you happen to be somebody who's published one book or two books, from what I can tell, it's not super helpful.
I don't think the publishers even really know what they're going to do yet. They're kind of feeling around. It's very similar to newspapers in my mind. You know, the newspapers are still trying to figure out what to do with this internet thing.
Well, no, I think you're right about that, but I think the bottom line is pretty simple. If the publisher doesn't make money, the publishers aren't going to do it. They may have a few loss leaders, but they're basically not going to do it. And there was an article in Blackgate a week or so ago, by Robert Silverberg, who was just asking the question, can the full-time novelist, particularly in science fiction, continue to exist? And I think that's, once you get beyond the bestseller list, so to speak, I think that's a real question, given the drop-off in paperback sales, which have always been the mainstay of the mid-list author. I think that's going to be a question if the ebook sales don't rise quickly enough to fill that gap.
Have you heard the call from different quarters to separate science fiction from fantasy in the bookstores? That science fiction should stand on its own and fantasy should be kind of set aside on its own. And it kind of goes to what you were talking about, because I can see that hurting science fiction.
Well, I can too, and I think it's a terrible idea, and I'll tell you why. Most people don't realize this, but about 10 to 15 years ago, the Southern book chain Books A Million did exactly that.
Really?
And I don't know when they quit doing it, but the last few times that I have been in their stores, they've now got them integrated. And I suspect they wouldn't have done that if they didn't think they would increase sales.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, how often does someone go into a bookstore looking for something from a favorite author and, you know, something on the shelf nearby, below it, on top of it, right beside it, kind of catches your eye and you pick it up, and before you know it, you found a new author.
Well, that's true, but you take me, for example. I read both. So does David Drake. We're probably among a vanishing minority that does it under our own names. David Farland is Dave Wolverton. He writes science fiction under Dave Wolverton, which is his real name, and he writes fantasy under David Farland, which is a pen name. And, of course, Nora Roberts and J.D. Robb are the same person. But there are some of us who write both, and the separation means that the readers wouldn't even know that the other stuff existed. And at least for me, that was certainly a problem when Books A Million was separating them that way.
I haven't seen a Books A Million in a really long time. I don't think I've seen one of those since I left California.
Well, they're basically a southern chain, even Southern California. I've never seen one in what I would call north, or not very far north of the Mason-Dixon line.
We have, I know we have Barnes & Noble Borders here in Denver, and then we also have the Tattered Cover, which is kind of a famous independent bookstore.
Oh, yes. I'm aware of all of those. Well, actually, was born in Denver, so
I did find that out today when I was doing my little due diligence. Denver is tied for my most favorite place ever to live with Chattanooga. Actually, I did meet you in person here in Denver at a book signing,
right?
Year ago.
I remember.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
Cool.
and you put it on your website.
I sure did. That's cool that you remember. You know, we've been doing this podcast for a while now, and I keep telling John that I am always pleasantly surprised at how warm and genuine all the authors are that we've been able to talk to. You're no different, and I just wanted to tell you that.
Thank you.
Are you planning to be at any conventions soon? Is there places where people can go and meet you?
As a matter of fact, yes. I will be at Fandemonium, which is a convention in Nampa, Idaho. And Nampa is a suburb or a joint city with Boise, the weekend of August 6th through the 9th. And then after that, the next convention I'm going to is in World Fantasy in Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
I'm likely to do a short appearance at the Mountain and Plains Independent Booksellers Association at their annual meeting in Denver around the 25th of September, but that's not been firmed up yet.
You should also come down for Mile High Con.
I can't do Mile High Con and do World Fantasy.
Ah.
They're too close together.
Gotcha.
And from where I live, it's an extra day to get any place. And frankly, my wife would kill me if I were gone for 2 weeks straight.
I understand. As I'm wrapping this up, do you have any advice for the young authors that are listening?
I guess the simplest advice is read everything you can, especially stuff outside the genre. Keep reading and keep up on developments, either political or whatever interests you, outside it, and write.
Yep. I agree with that wholeheartedly. All right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to share before we go?
I just turned in the manuscript for the fourth Imager portfolio book.
Nice.
Since I just turned it in, I don't know when they're going to publish it.
And there's no way we can talk you into another duology in the Spellsong cycle, huh?
I won't say no way.
I know.
My editor has said that he'd be certainly receptive to another book in that world, but not with those characters.
Well, just like with Recluse, you kind of set up that there were other societies that might tickle the fancy.
That's true, but I've also got my plate full at this stage of the game because I'm still active in Recluse, the Imager portfolio, and the Corian Chronicles. And I don't know if I can handle four fantasy series simultaneously. It's a little hard to handle three and write science fiction.
I believe you. I absolutely believe you. Well, I, for one, am happy just to... I mean, the series that you're talking about and the ones that you're working on are all within my favorites. It sounds like the Imager portfolio is going to be something that I'm going to really get into as soon as I crack that open. So at least I really appreciate all the books that you write. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the fact that you like them.
All right. Well, I think I'm going to go ahead and wrap this up. We've been talking with Ellie Modisett Jr., a best-selling author for Tord. And check out his website, elliemodisettjr.com. And you can see lists there of all the different books and all the different worlds that he writes in. And there you have it. episode 19 of the Functional Nerds. I'd like to thank Mr. Modisett for coming on. And it is that time in the show when we pimp our stuff. Of course, John's not here, so, but through the magic of the internet, he is here. Listen, you can hear him. I can hear him. Can you hear him?
I'm on Twitter at John Aneilio, JohnAneilio. My blog is scifisongs.blogspot.com. You can go there and get a lot of free music. You can also check out my album on iTunes or Amazon MP3 or CD Baby or a lot of other sources. Just put Sci-Fi Songs or John Aneilio in the search engines.
Okay, John. We got it. You pimped your stuff. My stuff. I've got the blog, atfmb.com, which stands for All Things From My Brain, and I post all kinds of funny little things up there, so you should go check that out. I've also got the Twitter feed, twitter.com/atfmb. I have the serialized science fiction that comes out every Friday, and that's over at atfmb.com/EVERMIST. Let's see. We also have functionalnerds.com, and there you can get the daily nerd news roundups as brought to you by 8-Bit Dad, Scott Seeley. Thank you for that, Scott. Next week, I don't know who is going to be on the show. I don't think John has told me. He may have told me, and I may have forgotten it. So I apologize, but I'm sure it'll be another really cool guest. So, come back next week, episode 20, Functional Nerds. I don't really have an outro for you tonight. I don't have anything. I mean, Skype's been acting okay. There's nothing weird there. So I don't really have anything. So I'll probably just play a John Aneilio song for you. I'll pick one randomly from the list and cue it up for you right about. Wait for it. Wait, almost now.
Jack the Ripper and his old dog Snuff prepared themselves with a wand and knife. Everything will be changed by the end of the game on this lonesome October night. Crazy Jill went to the top of the hill. Brave the cat was by her side. They had to open the gate before it was too late on this lonesome October night. Snuff the dog and his master Jack were the only closers there that night. Larry Talbot howled at the moon to give the openers a fright. The great detective had it all figured out before the clock had struck midnight. The elder gods will return and the city will burn on this lonesome October night. Yep. Jack and Jill faced each other on the hill. Snuff and Gray were by their side. Now everything's changed at the end of the game on this lonesome October night. On this lonesome October night. On this lonesome October night.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.